Harmon, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Baghdad, 2003. Hundreds of foreign correspondents descended on the Iraqi capital to report on the U.S.-led invasion. Amid all the coverage, the stories by New York Times correspondent John Burns stood out for their candor and depth. Burns officially retired from the paper just a few weeks ago. Later on The World, we'll be hearing some of his stories and recollections after four decades in the field. But first, I wanted Burns to give us his reaction to the news this week about Blackwater. Yesterday, four former security contractors with that company were sentenced for their role in a 2007 massacre in Baghdad that left 14 unarmed Iraqi civilians dead. Burns told me that he and other journalists in Iraq were wary of security contractors, especially Blackwater.
We were as much threatened by the security details who were protecting American military commanders, American military convoys sometimes, Iraqi politicians. And encountering one of those convoys was quite often a very, very unpleasant experience.
What was it about the contractors that made you feel threatened?
Well, they were not subject to either the full weight of or much weight of any kind of law, American or Iraqi. And we felt that whilst many of these people, I have to say, and there were, as you know, thousands and thousands upon them, of them, at one point, I believe, there were almost as many security contractors as there were American soldiers in Iraq. We, of course, traveled in armored vehicles of our own with our own security, who happily, in our case, never opened fire. But we came to know that the people who were protecting these convoys, we thought, were somewhat trigger-happy. Now, I say I've conflicted feelings about it because there was no doubt that they were subject to quite terrific dangers themselves. There were a lot of people who wanted them dead and who were shooting at them quite regularly or placing bombs or suicide bombs in cars. And they had very good reasons for having their fingers on the trigger. And the American military handled this by putting big, big boards on the back of the last vehicle in a convoy, warning you to stay at least 100 meters back. The private contractors were not so careful. And then we had this perfectly dreadful incident. So there were those who said at the time that this was inevitable, that Blackwater were known for being a pretty gung-ho outfit, and you didn't want to mess with Blackwater security guards. That said, the people who got themselves caught up in this terrible incident that day in Baghdad were people who went out every day, probably several times a day, into a situation which for them was potentially fatal. So you can see in all of this the components for the disaster that then ensued.
So for you, is this justice for the Iraqis who lost their lives and for their families who have continued living without them?
Oh, yes. I think there's no doubt that this will have a tremendous resonance for Iraqis who became to feel that they were caught between the two sides and who lost a lot of their faith in the American military as a result of incidents like this. I'm sure it's equally true that the families of these men who will now spend a good deal of the rest of their lives in prison will feel that there's been an injustice done to them. But I think if you're looking around for somewhere to place the blame for this beyond the people who opened fire in those very questionable circumstances in Baghdad that day, it was on the entire system that allowed private security contractors to operate with what we often felt was a willful disregard for the safety of others. This argument will go on for a very long time, and I doubt that it's going to be settled by this trial.
Retiring New York Times correspondent John Burns talking about the just-concluded Blackwater trial. A recent Times retrospective of his work reminded me of the story he filed in June of 1992 during the Balkan Wars. It's about the Bosnian capital of Sarajevo under siege. Burns describes howitzer shells whistling down as a disheveled man in evening attire unfolds a plastic chair and begins to play his cello on a city street. I asked Burns for the backstory to that story.
All the journalists, Western journalists in Sarajevo, agreed under UN pressure to leave the city because three Western journalists had been killed on a Saturday afternoon. The UN was leaving under a white flag and urged us to go. I very reluctantly agreed to go, got to the outskirts of the city and changed my mind, because at that point the utter destruction of Sarajevo began. and it was the murder of a city. And so after two or three days hesitating, because the journey back in was going to be extremely dangerous. Every moving vehicle was a target for an anti-tank shell or a rocket-propelled grenade. I decided to go back in with a photographer friend, and I thought the New York Times editors are going to be off for the weekend. They won't notice from their whereabouts list, as we call it, that I've gone dark, I've disappeared. They'll think I'm on my way, like all the other journalists, down to the Adriatic Sea at Split. So I've got two, possibly three working days to get in there and tell the story, the dramatic story of the murder of a European city. And I got in, and my option to get out was quickly removed by the fact that an artillery shell hit my rental car and literally blew it into 1,000 pieces. I worked all the 48 hours of that weekend to try and chronicle the destruction, the misery, the tragedy of it all. And I was writing on the Sunday afternoon for the Monday paper, wanting to get it into the Monday paper so as my editors could see and not order me out. When the photographer came to me in a cranny I had found in a building that was out of the immediate gun line of artillery fire, and said, "You've got to come with me," and a young Australian by the name of Andrew Reed. And I said, "I can't, Andrew, I'm on deadline. I've got to get this in. You know, we'll be in enough trouble as it is with New York. But, you know, if I don't get the story in now, tonight, then my job will be on the line." So under his urging, I followed him. He didn't tell me what it was. I went 200 or 300 meters down the street, the walking street, as they call it in Sarajevo. And there was this extraordinary sight of this man in evening dress playing Albinoni's Adagio. I mean, it was a tragic situation because he was sitting on the site of what became known as the Breadline bombing, people who had been queuing outside a bakery and were hit by a mortar or an artillery shell. And I think there were 26 of them killed. And when he packed up, there was nobody else around. It was far too dangerous. When he packed up his cello and came into the lee of the adjacent building, I said, "What on earth are you doing?" And he said, "I'm going to be doing this for 26 days in memory of all the people who died." Wow. And there were still blood stains where he was sitting beneath his plastic chair. And I said to him, "Why are you doing this?" And he said something which stuck with me ever since. He said, "Because it's the only thing I can do." He was playing his cello because he was a cellist I think he was the principal cellist for the Sarajevo Symphony Orchestra. He had no gun. He had no means of dealing with these murderous thugs on the hills who were destroying his city. So he did what he could, and he played the Adagio, and it was a moment of extraordinary beauty.
Did this cellist eventually escape Sarajevo?
He did, and he made, I'm very glad to say, quite a career for himself. There's a book written very much based on that instance called the Cellist of Sarajevo, I think it is. And he, you know, played as a guest player with some of the great orchestras of the world in Berlin and New York and Los Angeles and elsewhere. There's an island now. The first thing he said to me when I pulled him aside as he packed up his cello that Sunday afternoon, I said, "Would you mind talking to me a little bit?" He said, "Who's buying the whiskey?" And there was a bar hidden away in the narrow alleyways nearby, which I came to love, where he played Croatian folk music, which is music of great beauty, and told me his story. And I think Vedran was able to down a few whiskeys.
So you know his story, John Burns. What is it like to think back over four decades and all the people you've met, people in crisis, people in dire straits, people who've lost loved ones, the children, and to think about what's come of them now?
Well, of course, I only rarely hear what's become of them. In some cases where my wife, who was often in these places with me, we were able to help people get out. We know what became of them, and they've remained friends. But of course, in the nature of the experience, a lot of them we saw in extreme distress and have not seen since. But I will say this, war, as we all know, is an expression of the darkest instincts in the human spirit. But what is not quite so well recognized is that it also generates an equal and opposite force of good. It brings the extraordinary out of people who are otherwise quite ordinary. And it's an extraordinarily inspiriting thing. And people ask me, why did you stick at this so long and so many wars? There's no doubt that living on that narrow margin between existence and oblivion is an exhilarating thing. It would be vain to deny that it's an exhilarating way to spend your life. But I think if you have any sort of spirit or soul, you would have to say that it is just an extraordinarily inspiring thing to work among people who are being subjected to utter misery and often to death, and to see how brave, how generous, and how they look after each other, and how little they complain. And it puts one's own travails in life, and we all have them, into perspective. And when it came time to leave Sarajevo, for example, and my editors, I think, felt that I was probably a little overcommitted there after 2 years of all this gunfire, it was leaving behind a city of then probably 250,000 people who had come to me to be the real heroes. After all, I had a flak jacket, I had a fistful of dollars and a helmet, and I had food, things they did not have. And they looked after me. They often saved my life. And I was back there recently for the first time in 20 years. And it was an absolutely enrapturing experience to meet some of those people who are now living again, not in a perfect city, not in a perfect world, but they're living in Sarajevo in peace, and their children have grown up and prospered. Some of them have gone abroad and prospered in America. Sarajevo is a place in the heart for me.
Well, John Burns, thanks for telling us about a few of them. Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
A look back at the career of New York Times correspondent John Burns brings this edition of The World to a close today, along with the sounds of Vedran Smilovic, the cellist in Sarajevo that Burns wrote about in 1992. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman.